Spooky South Coast. Tim Weisberg here, along with the silent assassin, Matt Costa. Science advisor Matt Moniz will be here in a few minutes because he had to step out for a bit. And Stephanie Burke is here as well. Good evening, and we are here to talk about the paranormal as we are each and every Saturday night. And we have a an actual over-the-air show tonight. We're actually on the radio, which is nice for a change. I thought you were going up to a microphone. I was like, where's he going? Does he have something to say? We are broadcasting live on WBSM and on Spooky TV at SpookySouthCoast.com and on the Spooky South Coast app and on YouTube. And I'm pretty sure if you tie two coconuts together with a string, maybe some old cans, you can pick up the show as well. Lots of different ways to pull us in. And tonight we're going to be talking. First of all, we've got a full lineup tonight. We're going to hear from Ashley with The Week in Weird coming up in just a few moments. Then we will be joined by Tim Banal, who, if you are not a listener of Banal of America, then you need to be. We're going to share some memories with him of the late Jim Mars. Jim Mars passed away earlier this week. Huge influence on Tim Banal and Banal of America. Huge influence on me, and I know Moniz as well, and Spooky South Coast. We've been fortunate enough to have him a few times here on the program. So we're going to remember Jim for a little bit on tonight's show. And then later on, we'll be joined by Steve Asher. We're going to be talking about one particular case tonight. We're going to be talking about the hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. So that should be a pretty interesting journey through the Kentucky State Penitentiary with Steve E. Asher coming up a little bit later on in the show. So we've got a lot of ground to cover and a little bit of time to do it. We waited a little bit there for the Red Sox post-game show to end, just because if we were in the middle of trying to start our stuff and that went off the air, like the computer gets all frozen, so we figured let's just wait a few minutes and let's be able to go over the air from the start of the show. The WBSM audience hasn't heard us in weeks.
That's true.
Because last week, I think we never even made it. Last week, the game was late, I think. So we never even made it onto the radio. Right? I don't remember. I was coming right from wrestling, so
I wasn't here.
I don't recall. And then I know the week before that, I think we might have made it on like the last 10 minutes or so. So it's good to be able to talk to you, the audience. And remember, you can call in at any time during the show at 508-996-0500, 877-996-1420 to call in toll-free. And you can always join in the chat room on Spooky TV, which you can get to through the Spooky South Coast app, through our website, SpookySouthCoast.com, and through YouTube. I want to say hi to everybody in the chat room tonight. Thank you for hanging out and waiting while we were waiting to get going. And you can also email us, SpookyCrew@SpookySouthCoast.com, and you can tweet us at SpookySC or use the hashtag SpookyLive. So we don't make it any easier for you, really. Like, you can take part in the show sitting on your couch in your underwear. We have people that do.
In your underwear, really?
I've done the show in my underwear.
Have you?
Yes.
Thank you.
I've definitely done other people's shows in my underwear, that's for sure. If you hear me on somebody else's podcast, chances are I was not wearing pants at the time.
I think I wear pants for all shows I do.
Nope, not me. I think I would prefer, because when I'm home, I don't wear any. I'm like Murray Goldberg when I get home. Pants go off. Sitting in my chair, leave me alone. But we have been very fortunate that the camera angles are high enough that you can't tell the difference one way or another.
There you go.
So you don't know if I'm wearing pajamas, which I've been known to do in the past. You don't know if I'm sitting here in just a pair of shorts. So, but I am a little bit lower tonight. I do feel a little bit weird.
You do.
I had to bring this chair in from the newsroom because I can't sit on that one.
That one is awful.
I want to say congratulations to Phil Paleologus for being, you know, Nielsen rated number one.
That's awesome.
Yes, he's the number one morning show in our target demographic, and he beat some of the bigger stations around here. People love listening to Phil. I don't know how Phil does that show for 4 hours every morning sitting on that stool.
No. Nope.
Especially when he's been doing it for so many years. You know, he's been in radio for so long. And
they need a new chair. Look, it's falling apart.
It is. But you know how it goes here. If there's a nice, comfy chair in the studio, they're all going to fight over who gets to take it with them at the end of the show. And
yep.
So I think, you know, it's better to just sneak in this one from the newsroom. Nobody will know the difference. But I just know that it makes it harder for Matt with the cameras. So why don't we get into the Week in Weird with Ashley. Now, this is a recorded one. She's actually at the Payne House tonight.
They're
doing some investigating there. But she sent this along. So let's go to the Week in Weird with Ashley Turner.
No, we're not talking about Bigfoot, Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster. We're talking about stranger and bigger things, such as the Dover Demon, located right here in Massachusetts. It's described by an eyewitness as being about 4 feet tall on two legs, with a hairless body, rough textured skin, long, spindly peach-colored limbs, a large watermelon-shaped head, nearly as big as its body, and large glowing eyes. It's a super creepy photo, so check that out. And also in the article, it covers the Loveland Lizard, the Mothman, and the Jersey Devil. So check it out and tell me what you think, and maybe some of this is lurking in your own backyard and you don't even know. So keep me updated on that. The next story comes from Peru. It's quoted from the title, Strange Factor, Dead Alien Baby and Pregnant Mother Found Inside Tomb of Peru. Quoted right from the article, researchers are investigating the alleged discovery of several alleged mummified aliens, also claimed now to have found the corpse of what appears to be a baby. The Express.co of the UK revealed the first pictures of the alleged to be secret tomb where several mummified aliens were found. It's a pretty cool article, has a lot of information in it, it has a really neat video that goes along with it. Check it out, the pictures are really interesting as well, and let me know what you think. And my last story was only released a few days ago, titled Dashcam Captures Spooky Shadow Person in Ireland. Quoted straight from the article, a strange piece of footage from Ireland appears to show some kind of shadow person crossing the road and vanishing into thin air. But people are picking the video apart as people pick everything apart, and they're saying that the content might be a hoax and that the person of the car shouldn't be afraid, as it might be just a person simply walking through an opening in the wall, or rather than slipping into a different dimension. Check the video out, let me know what you think, and I will see you guys next week. Bye!
All right, that is Ashley Turner with The Week in Weird. And of course, that's always posted up online. And I know, Matt, you've been taking up the video and posting The Week in Weird on its own. So we highly recommend that you grab that, you download it, you share it, whatever you want to do. If you want to put it on your site, we're cool with that. You know, just do whatever you want to do to help spread the word and keep things weird out there. And speaking of keeping things weird, we have a guy who's been keeping things weird for as long as we have been. And that is Tim Benall. He is joining us on the line right now. Good evening, Tim. Is that you on the line?
Hey, what's going on?
What's happening?
Spooky South Coast crew.
It's been a while since we've had you.
Thanks for having me on.
We haven't had you on the show in a long time.
What's a long, long time. I'm sorry that that my return would come on such a downer with such a sad reason for the return. But
absolutely.
I appreciate that you asked me to come on, so thanks.
Well, I mean, there's nobody else that we could talk to that could talk about the impact that Jim Mars had any more than you, because, you know, same thing. I remember being a college student. I was a sophomore at UMass Dartmouth, and I was taking the course Political Assassinations in America, and it was taught by the great Philip Melanson, who was also no longer with us. And as I'm taking that course, you know, all the name that he kept mentioning over and over again was Jim Mars, his research. And he told me, he's like, listen, if you want to read the definitive JFK assassination book, you have to get Crossfire. And so I went out and I got it, and I would spend hours talking about it with Professor Melanson. And I was fortunate enough that when we started doing this show, sent an email to Jim Mars, and he agreed to do it. And so it must have been similar for you that, you know, you must have come across his work well before you were even doing Banal of America.
Yeah. It's a crazy, crazy, crazy story, man. It's like Jim passing on Wednesday, just kind of, it's like, it's hard to explain, but it's like, it's like thinking about someone you knew, something that happened to you, like a great band or something, you know, that was a pivotal part of your life when you were really young, you know what I mean? But the added layer of, like, then you get to meet the band, you know, and you get to know the band. So it's like, it brought all these memories for me back about how pivotal he was in my life. He really, if not for him, I mean, I wouldn't be talking to you guys today. It was like, I just, one day in the fall of 2002, such a long time ago, I was just looking for a book to read and picked up Rule by Secrecy. And, you know, it's Bruce Springsteen has a great line about Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, that snare shot at the beginning of the song. It kicks open the door to your mind. And that's kind of what happened with me and Jim's book. That book just, it kicked open the door to my mind. And I went out and got Alien Agenda and Crossfire, like, all within the next 2 weeks, and read all that stuff, and then it was like, I need to know more about all of this stuff. And I had an interest in all this when I was younger, as a kid and everything, but it was like, this is what brought it all on, this mm-hmm. book, and Jim, and his work and everything. So to me, he was always, I wrote a little something about him on Facebook the other day, and it's like, he wasn't like a mentor. I mean, he was a friend for sure. But to say he was like a mentor or a hero, like, goes even beyond everything. He was like a shaman for me, man. He was like a shaman. He was like, I had elevated him to like godlike status. Because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't have all these friends like you guys. All of my friends, like, you know, all of my friends, with the exception of like people I knew in high school and college, like all of them. You know, and maybe a few other people, but it's like most of my adult friends came from in the paranormal, and it's like I wouldn't know any of these people, and I would have gone down a whole different path in life. And it's really, I mean, and like things I hadn't thought about in a long, long time came kind of flooding back to me this week, where it was like, I mean, it's I don't talk about it a lot, but most people know I work for Coast to Coast, and it's like I finished reading Jim's books, and I said to myself, where can I hear an interview with this guy? And I went to Google, and that's how I found Coast to Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I wouldn't even have this job I have, you know? It's like my, I mean, I'd be looking at a completely different life if it wasn't for Jim Morris. And he was just so, so gracious and kind and, you know, helpful. When I started my show, I had never even done an interview. I mean, I had done some of these, like, sit-down interviews at a convention where I actually had met him for the first time in 2004. Well, you sit at the vendor table, and I interviewed Stan Friedman. That was the first person I ever interviewed. I think I did, like, two other interviews. But the first time I ever did a Banal of America interview like I do now over the phone, it's like, that was Jim. And it's another, like, thing that I hadn't thought of in a while was that I didn't know what I was doing or anything, and it's like Jim liked to talk. He was loquacious. He could really tell a story, and so I had like maybe 15 questions, and I probably only got to half of them. And we had done an hour about this time of year too, I think like 12 years ago. And I was like, I mean, because I didn't know any better. I didn't know it was probably rude to ask. I didn't know any better, so like we did the hour, and I was like, hey, can I interview you, like, for an hour next week and get the rest of these questions done? And he was like, sure, same time next week. And I was like, he didn't have to do that, dude. This is Jim Morris, man.
Right.
But he did. And, I mean, I know, I can assure you can speak to this in a lot of ways, too. It was like, that was the first interview we did for, like, the show as a real show. And it gave us instant credibility, you know? It put us on the map instantly. Because we had Jim Morris. And there were so few shows back then that it was like, for all the guys that were like me, that were like, I got to find an interview with Jim Morris. All of a sudden, we were on the map,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was so much easier to get other guests. Because when you can go to get a guest and you say, well, who have you had on the show? Jim Morris. Oh, yeah, you had Jim on, then yeah, for sure.
Right, absolutely. He
was the best, man. He was really the best.
Absolutely. What impressed me the most about him was, you know, you start thinking, before you really delve into this world and you start reading books and listening to interviews and seeing people on television, you know, now there's stuff about conspiracy theories all the time on television, but people don't realize that was few and far between way back then. And so you would think of somebody that's a conspiracy theorist as being this nut job that lives out in a Unabomber shack out in the woods. Then you read a book by Jim Morris and you say, well, wait a minute. This guy sounds like he must be like the ultimate Washington insider. You know, he's probably like some, you know, Secret Service kind of CIA black ops type of guy. And then you turn over the back cover of the book and you see this guy and he's just this laid back, you know, folksy, down home, looks like he could be your grandfather. And that's how he was as a person.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think he was like the best of all worlds in a sense, I think, because it was like he had sort of the look of the cool sort of conspiracy guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had like the bushy beard, the Santa Claus type beard and the trademark hat and the sunglasses, and it was like he kind of gave off that like conspiracy vibe. But then when you heard him, he was so eloquent. He's such a storyteller. He could lay stuff out. You know, he had this way of like telling you, laying out like the facts in a way that like when he finished sort of the bit, if you will, and that's sort of like, that's a poor choice of words. But when he finished sort of what he was trying to say, it always sort of came around to like a funny little sort of ending that made you think. You know what I mean? He would sort of set you up with all these facts and then come back at the end with some little thing that tied it all together where you're like, oh, wow. And he would have that laugh. He would have that laugh, man. He would have that laugh. You know, and that was that. You know, he was. I'm sure he confounded many a TV producer who was like, "Oh yeah, we'll get this guy on. He's just some country bumpkin or something like that." And then and then they get him on, and he was incredibly eloquent, incredibly well spoken, and thoughtful, and funny, and entertaining. And he didn't come off as like creepy or paranoid or anything. You know, he didn't have any of the bad traits that you expect from these conspiracy folks. That's what I loved about him, you know? It was like, he didn't come off as threatening. He came off as like, hey, man, it's going to be okay, but here's what's going on.
And he wasn't one of these, you know, crackpots either that as much as he was able to expose over the course of his career and as much as he was able to bring to the forefront, he wasn't one of these guys that was hiding in a bunker somewhere. I mean, this is a guy that every day was on Facebook, and he would like your photos and comment under things. And, you know, this was not a guy that was afraid of the stuff that he was writing about.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it was a great, great, great pleasure of mine and a joy that I was out in Dallas. I don't think we ever talked about this, you and I, but
no.
You know, I was out in Dallas last spring, and a bunch of us got together, and we went to Dealey Plaza and the usual sort of haunts. And on Sunday of that that weekend, we went to Aurora, where allegedly there was a alien spacecraft, a UFO crashed, and they buried an alien in the graveyard in Aurora. And Jim lived near, pretty close to there, and one of the guys that was down there knew Jim. And called him, and he came out to Aurora and just hung out with us in the afternoon. Listen, folks, there are people in this field that wouldn't have done that. They wouldn't have done that for if you didn't offer them money.
Right.
Okay? If you didn't, they'd ask you how much you got. You know? It was like, we didn't even know Jim was going out there. He was like, oh, a bunch of people going out there from all over the country. You know, that's cool. I'll come out and hang out and tell them about it. You know?
It's just amazing how just approachable he was, how down to earth he was, and really how much of, you know, he was always willing. Every time I contacted him and said, you know, we'd love to have you come on the show, I see you have a new book out or what have you, you know, he always found a way to make time. And there was even, it didn't even have to be about being on the show. You know, it would be perfectly fine. Hey, just give me a call and we'll talk sometime. And that's very rare to find in this field, to have somebody who, because people compartmentalize this stuff so much in their lives, it's very rare to have somebody that's willing to be like, hey, call me anytime with any questions you may have, whether it's on the radio or not.
Yeah. No, he was, you know, I liken him a lot to Stan Friedman in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was very approachable, and it's like paradoxically approachable. He was such a big star. You know, it's like people, yeah, I mean, I could call him up anytime I want, you know, and I'd leave a message if I didn't get him, and he'd call me back, you know, and as you can imagine, like, and I'm sure you kind of went through this too, and it's kind of why this is such a tough loss, is just that, like, he was so pivotal in my life, you know. It's like they say don't meet your heroes, but I did, and it was awesome.
Well, and, you know, we had been following along for the last couple of months. He had been sick. He had some complications from diabetes. He had lost his sight. I don't know if he ever regained his sight.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know a lot of the details about...
I'm just going by what I saw on Facebook.
I don't know anything more than you do. You know, I just know it was a tough... It looked pretty bad a couple months ago, you know. And there was a lot of... At the time, there were people sort of like saying that he wasn't going to make it like for a week or through the week or something like that.
Right.
So at that point, that's why when the news started going around on Wednesday afternoon, I was like, well, I'm going to wait till I hear something legit.
Right. Because,
even from, and I mean, there were people who were saying, who were, you know, kind of confirming it and everything. But even then, I was like, until I see it on his page, I'm not going to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And a lot of that, I think, was my own refuse, not wanting to believe it was true.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
yeah.
there were people that I respect that were like, saying, you know, putting condolences up and everything, and it was like, yeah, that's cool, but until I, it's like the impossible, like, until I can hear it from Jim himself, I'm not going to believe this, you know, but, and then when Jim's family posted it, it was like, you know, the dam broke for me. It was like, all right, this is real.
Yeah, I mean, I'd come out of my lecture, I was doing a Lizzie Borden lecture, and I came out to the information coming at me from John Tenney, and immediately I reached out to you because I figured, you know, first of all, Tenney would know if it happened, but I also knew that you would know if it did, and so that was kind of like a double confirmation for me to say, okay, you know, I feel like I can take this to our audience and share it with them, and I don't think it can be said enough. Even though we've only had him on the show here a few times, I don't think it can be said enough how much of an influence he was on everything that we do. You, before Jim Mars talking about things that you weren't supposed to be talking about, you know, we would not be allowed to be on the radio discussing a lot of these things. They would tell us, they would probably tell us, hey, you guys can't talk about JFK assassination once a year. We don't want you guys talking about 9/11 conspiracies or any of this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he, like, well, I'm not, this isn't to, like, put myself over it all. It's just sort of to tie into another thing, but it's like, yeah, I mean, you never would have met me, you never had me on the show. I know Marie Jones said when she first started getting involved with, and this was early because she said it when she was in MUFON in California, which is like when she first got into all this, that Jim was like integral to helping her out. It's like, and I'm sure there's a lot of other people, you know,
right.
I'm sure there are, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that, like, I mean, it's like a coach's tree, in a sense, you know? It's like, because I've talked to people who were like, I've had people on my show who, as frightening as this sounds, who were like, yeah, one of the reasons I got into this is I listened to your show,
mm-hmm.
and I really got into this and started looking into this topic and decided to write a book. And it was like, whoa, like, I'm there, Jim Mars? Like, this is weird, you know? So it's like, and then, in you know, so in turn, it's like, they wouldn't be around. So it's like, because if I didn't do this, then, you know, they wouldn't have been listening to the show. You know, it's like a crazy, it's like this butterfly effect where he just had a profound influence on all this, you know, a really profound influence. I mean, he was one of the really big stars, like big, you know, he was an icon, a legend, you know,
mm-hmm.
you can't, like, he was just like larger than life, tremendous, you know.
I think,
can't put him over enough.
I think we have somebody on the line here that might want to call in and share a memory of Jim, and we'll see if we can take that call. Good evening. You're on Spooky South Coast. How are you? Hello? All right. Well.
What was that? Hello?
No, you're still with us, but I was trying to bring in another call, but it sounds like somebody wasn't there. But if anybody did want to call in, the number is 508-996-0500 if you want to call in and share your thoughts of Jim Mars. Now the question is, I mean, I know that Jim had been a little bit less prolific over the last few years with his health and, you know, and just being older and wanting to kind of enjoy things a little bit more. He was still pretty active in all of his research, but you just didn't see him as much. Out there anymore. There's got to be a new vanguard of people, though, who have been picking up the mantle of what he's been doing over the years.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, believe me, yeah. Well, one point I wanted to make, in a sense, that just to, I guess I can't even sort of address that question without sort of talking about this, in a sense, is that, like, this is another thing that I was thinking about this week was, you know, if you look at his books, he wrote Crossfire, that's the JFK assassination, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then he wrote Rule by Secrecy, which is just like a worldwide conspiracy, like a world history conspiracy book. I can't, folks, get this book. If you have not read this book, it's a seminal work. And then, shortly thereafter, he wrote Alien Agenda, which is like the whole, like, history of the UFO phenomenon. And I was thinking about this week, and it was like, you know, I look at all these different topics on my show, and I never fell into the trap of specialization. And it's like, because that's what, you know, just like the light bulb, like, went off in my head. And it was like, because that's what Jim did.
Right.
You know, that's how Jim Mars did it. He looked at all the different topics. That's why I look at all the different topics, because I was raised on the idea from his stuff that you can look at all the different stuff. You know what I mean? Sort of like, to speak to what you're saying, I guess, and like the reason why I kind of wanted to make that point first is that it's like, well, who's like filling in his shoes and stuff like that? It's like he pretty much cut across the whole like genres.
Right.
You know, it's like who's, I guess the question is like, who are the charismatic young people that are going to take his place? You know what I mean? It's like a Micah Hanks or something like that. He's young because you need somebody who's like, who connects with people and is larger than life. Micah Hanks is like that, you know?
And I think part of his legacy,
you know, Nick
too.
Redfern's like that in a different sense, where he like covers all these different topics and stuff. But it's like we come from an older age, man. I mean, it's like there's a certain like era of like, in my mind, of like paranormal conspiracy like superstar type characters. You know what I mean? Like a Stan Freeman, Jim Mars, Lauren Coleman. I'm sure he'll love me following his name up with like David Icke or Alex Jones. You know, like there's only like maybe 8 to 10 people who are like in the class that Jim was in. You know, and to me, they're all like, there's nobody. You know, I think Micah Hanks could be there someday. I think Nick Redfern could be there someday. God, I wish I could be there someday, but that's probably not going to ever be possible. But it's like there's, you know, but I don't think. Does any, you know, the closest person I would say that's sort of like riding that crest between sort of the old guard and what might come next is like a Rich Dolan. That's probably the person I can think of that's like, at some point they become bigger than the paranormal. Their name is like, they are, you know, it's like it's the WWE and it's John Cena.
I also,
of the few people that matches the brand. So it's like as far as that goes, like I guess like Rich Dolan or something like that. I guess to answer in a long-winded, very inside baseball sort of answer.
But I also think too that part of Jim's legacy is that there doesn't have to be somebody that will fill that role either. The fact that more people are out there doing this, more people are out there peeling back the layers, and it is something that we can have a conversation about without it being, you know, nobody thinks you're crazy if you want to sit down and have a conversation about the JFK assassination and about the conspiracy theories involved in that. People are willing to sit there and kind of dissect it all and figure it all out. They might not subscribe to all the theories, but at least you're not considered a nut job for talking about it. And I think that that's what Jim did more than anything, is he humanized the idea of thinking that the story that we're being told might not be the whole story.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because, well, there's so many outlets for people nowadays that it's like certain people don't just aren't like, there's just more opportunities. So more people get opportunities, if that makes any sense. You know what I mean? So, and he's, guys like him and all those folks I was just talking about, sort of the old guard of like, you know, the Uber stars, they're the ones that kind of opened those doors for people and, you know, made the paranormal kind of ushered it into as close to the mainstream as it is now.
And as you said, for everybody who hasn't delved into Jim's works and hasn't read his writings and even just going to his website, you know, A View from Mars, where he would post up random thoughts sometimes and put up blogs and just get yourself into the mind of how he saw the world and take some of that into your own approach. Take some of that into the way that you, especially today, I don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but if you just look at everything that's going on today, I mean, I just know that there was a book coming from Jim if he had not passed, if he had not left us. There would have been some sort of a book about everything that's going on today because he would have been the guy to figure it all out and to peel back all those layers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If anything, that's kind of one of the heartbreaking parts of obviously Jim passing. It's very heartbreaking. All the, you know, it's like one of those things that catches you later where you're like, oh, you know, he's not going to see how this plays out. You know,
but in some regard,
yeah, he gets to go and explore and find the answers. You know, on the other end, it's like if the afterlife is what I hope and pray that it is, then he's out there right now getting the answers to all these questions. He's like a kid in a candy shop right now.
Oh, absolutely.
And I, you know, it makes me smile. I can only imagine what. You know, he's sitting there on the grassy knoll right now, saying, "Play it again."
Yep.
All right, back it up. Play it again. Okay, let me see. You know, walking around, looking at all, looking at history unfold. You know, he's sitting there in Roswell right now being like, okay, let me see that for one more time, how it came down. All right, okay, I can see how that, you know. He's there in spirit form watching it all and you know, studying it. So, I mean, God bless him. I hope I can be there someday. I hope I'm good enough to get there someday and you know, be alongside all those people trying to figure it out on the other, or finding the answers out on the other side, I hope.
Well, one of the things that I always remember strongly about my conversations with him is, you know, he would always he'd reference ghosts in some way, or maybe I would, and he would always say, you know, but that's your thing. He's like, that's not really my thing. That's your thing. You know more about that than I do. You know, you know that's your area. And I'm like, is Jim Morris comparing like my knowledge of ghosts with his knowledge about the topics that he knows about? Like, you don't understand. Like, I know like 1% of what I'm interested in compared to like what he knows about what he's interested in. And it's just, it was always mind-blowing that he would defer to somebody else about anything because he was just a human encyclopedia of things.
Yeah, for real. He was always like, if he knew it, he would tell you about it. And if he didn't know it, he wouldn't BS you. You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the impression I got. Because I would ask some arcane sort of questions on the show. And if he didn't really have an answer, you know, if he was like, yeah, well, I haven't really looked that much into that thing, but, you know, here's what I can say about it. You know what I mean? He would at least qualify stuff with an explanation. He's one of these people who wouldn't fly off at the mouth and just make things up.
And I think that is what will kind of be his lasting legacy, is if people can kind of follow in that mold. And, of course, you always talk to people on Banal of America. Before we let you go here, we do want to let people know about the new season of Banal of America. You are taking this in some very interesting directions this season.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's gotten really interesting in the last few weeks. Not that it wasn't before, but it's getting, like, even more. We've, like, smashed the fourth wall. We're, like, really getting into, like, the looking glass type areas of stuff. Like, what is going on with ufology? What is the state of this field? And I had you and Chris Balzano on for a fascinating conversation where we deconstructed ghosts, sort of just the ghost community, you know, and it was, like, so interesting. I really, really enjoyed that conversation so much.
Same
and,
here.
It's my final season. I'm not, I'm coming back in some form or fashion after I do this, but traditionally the show is, like, 33 episodes spaced out over the course of a year or so,
mm-hmm.
Broken down into seasons, kind of like an album, and here, when we got to our 10th season, I knew back in season 8 that this was going to be the end, and it was like, I think I kind of dragged my feet getting it started for like 6 to 8 months because I knew it was the last one. But once we got it going, it's been unbelievable. I can honestly say, and I was thinking this today, I forgot I was going to be on the show tonight, but I was thinking to myself as I was putting up the newest episode, I was like, and I mean, you can attest to this, Tim. Like, you don't say it out loud, or you don't say it sort of like to the audience. You may allude to it at some point, but it's like sometimes you get some dogs. You know, sometimes you get some right. episodes where you're like, oh, that was not fun. You know, or it's like that was not what I thought it would be, or that's not what I hoped it would be.
Yeah, it's just a chore and, getting to the end. Yep.
Yeah, and I was putting the episode up today, and I said to myself, this has been unbelievable. This is the 13th episode of the season, and I'm like, I haven't had a single episode where I've got off the phone where I was disappointed. Like, every episode I've gotten off the phone, I was like, wow, that was amazing. Like, that was just an amazing conversation, and they're all so different. So I hope folks check it out. I'm actually going on vacation for 2 weeks, so now's the time to dig into the archive.
Absolutely.
And, yeah,
and it's
lots of good stuff on there.
Banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. And again, just go back and listen to every season, really, but some fascinating stuff. And it's got to be – this is definitely part of that vanguard that I was talking about. You know, your show is definitely the next phase. This is what Jim laid the groundwork for, was for you to be able to do a show like that. So thank you for all that you do, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Because we did a show, our show was on Tuesday night, and Jim passed away on Wednesday, and I'm not coming back for a couple weeks, so I wouldn't have had a venue actually to sort of like talk all this out. So I really appreciate it, because I tried writing a lot of it down, but didn't couldn't really. It's easier said than written.
Right. Well, you know you're welcome here anytime.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it. And, thanks again. And rock on, Spooky South Coast.
All right. Take care. Have a good vacation.
Thanks, man. Good night.
Have a good one. That is Tim Banal, banalofamerica.com. Definitely check it out. I highly recommend it. It's been fascinating listening for years, for as long as we've been around, too. We're going to take a break now. When we come back on the other side, we'll be joined by Steve Asher. We're going to be talking about the ghosts of the hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary, and we're going to get into some of these stories because, it's really fascinating when you can kind of zero in on one particular location and one particular case, and we're going to do that tonight. And, of course, we'll take your calls as well, 508-996-0500. 877-996-1420 if you want to call in with any thoughts. You can also send them to us via email, spookycrew@spookysouthcoast.com, or you can jump right in the chat room at spookysouthcoast.com, where we have live streaming video. You can actually see all the cameras in the studio and see everybody as the show is going on. Matt does all kinds of great stuff with the Spooky TV, so make sure you check that out. All right, we'll be back in just a few minutes with more Spooky South Coast here on WBSM. There we go. There we are. There I am. Welcome back. Hour number two of Spooky South Coast. Tim Weisberg with you. Gonna kick up my headphones here. That's what's weird about this board is that, well, it's always been this way, but sometimes you can only hear yourself out of one ear. And I can never tell which ear is my good ear, so I don't know which way to put the headphones on for when that happens. We are back. We are talking about the paranormal as we do each and every Saturday night. And we won't be here next Saturday night. We have an event coming up. We'll be having Ghosts of the Gateway 2017 at the Fearing Tavern and the three other buildings owned by the Wareham Historical Society. We do this every year as a fundraiser for them, and it's one of the premier events for them each year. So we do it as a way to kind of raise some money for them, and we would like everybody to come on out and take part. There's still some tickets available. You can get those at SpookySouthCoast.com. I know that one newspaper already ran a story on it in Wareham, but the other one will probably have something on it this week. So you probably don't want to wait too long to get your tickets, because by the time it hits that, you know, then all the summer people are going to be like, "Well, that sounds like fun," and then
hunting for ghosts.
Yeah, so we'll certainly give you a good dose of Wareham history too at the same time. So
it's really a fun event. We do it every year. We try to do it every year.
We're going to try and do it yearly now. We were doing it kind of every other year, but we're going to try and do it every year for them at some point, whether it be in the summer or in the fall, just so that we can help them out and help them raise some money. And again, if you've never been to any of these buildings, the Fearing Tavern was built in 1690, the oldest part of the building. When do you get to investigate a place built in 1690?
It's a weird place.
When do you even really get to go into a place built in 1690? There's so many few houses, so many few houses left around that are even from the 1600s. You know, we're just losing them more and more because people don't want to have to deal with the upkeep involved in them.
Or they don't have the funds to do so. So that's why we do this event.
There was a couple months ago or a couple weeks ago, I shared a house for sale. There was a story in the newspaper of a house from 1650. And
that's when you wanted to buy, right?
I did. I mean, if I had, $350,000 kicking around, I would maybe buy that house. But the more I thought about it...
So much upkeep.
Well, but that's the problem, is the house had already been kind of all redone. So...
Really?
I don't know that I'd want to live in it then. You know, everything kind of looked modernized.
Okay. All right.
And they kind of had taken some of the older parts of it and updated it a bit. Mm-hmm. And some of it still had the same look and the same appeal, but you could tell, like, it wasn't the same function anymore. You know, and I'd want it to be completely as is. If I was going to, you know, I want to live in it the way that it was
might be a little
in
cold.
1650. Well, I mean, I'd still want to have the heat and the running water and the bathroom
right
inside of it. But I'm just saying, like, I don't want you to take all of the, you know, original beams and cover them over with a drop ceiling.
Right.
You know, like, that kind of stuff just aggravates me to no end. You know, I want it to be authentic. And that's what you get when you go into the Fearing Tavern. It's been completely redone, so it looks like it would have back then. And you get the chance to go in and explore a whole night where you can hunt for ghosts in four different buildings. And all the buildings have activity. All the buildings have had stuff happen over the years.
Right.
SpookySouthCoast.com is the place to go and get tickets if you want to take part. Hopefully we will see you next Saturday night. But, again, for the radio audience, we will not be here next Saturday night as we have that event. So keep that in mind. If you are tuning in and looking for us and wondering if we're going to be on YouTube and all that stuff, nope, no show next week. But for the remainder of this week, we're going to be joined now by our guest, Steve Asher. And Steve Asher is a paranormal researcher who's also a freelance writer and artist, as well as a lover of music. Previously, he worked over 10 years in law enforcement and as a correctional officer. Steve is a longtime researcher of the paranormal. He's traveled worldwide, most recently to Thailand, where he and his wife adopted one of their two sons. Steve is also an avid lover of the nighttime. He says that this is when he feels most truly alive in the darkness of the night and therefore most productive in his paranormal research and writing. He is a native of Princeton, Kentucky, and he joins us on the line right now. Steve, are you with us? Hold on now. All right, now can you hear me, Steve?
Yes, yes, sir.
You think I would know how to do this by now, after all these years?
The magic of live radio.
Hey, and that's what's great about it. You know, you say, it says in your bio that you do your best work at night, and so do we. The problem is our best work is when we're falling asleep. So I'm kind of falling asleep at the switch here tonight.
I think you're going to do just fine.
So I have to say that, first of all, in your bio, it mentions that you spent a good amount of time working in law enforcement. And before we even get into the hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary, which is the name of the book, I'm just going to say, across the board, whether it's ghosts or anything, you must see some really weird stuff in the corrections field.
Well, sure. I mean, are we talking paranormal or just freaky?
Anything weird?
There's a lot. There's a lot of both. Sure, there is. I mean, anytime you have a certain amount of the population that tend to have chaos around them, and you put them into an environment where it's historically had that sort of activity and that sort of tension and that sort of anguish and all those emotions that go in with being locked in and having to deal with some of your own issues, because that's the thing about the penitentiary. It's not a reformatory. It's not a boys' camp. It's about penance. At one time, actually, they used to have a big sign in the front, and it said, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." So it really kind of set the tone for, you've kind of reached the end of the line, and here you'll stay. And then a lot of them did. But that's for sure that you're going to see all kinds of weird things like that. But I never saw anything to the extent, not just myself, but have other people, confirm certain situations that I'd saw or experienced, like I did at the Kentucky State Penitentiary. It's just, you know, it's beyond everything that I'd ever dealt with, because I'd worked in, you know, minimum security stuff. I've worked in jails and things like that, but the time there, it's really a timeless, really old facility. It looks kind of like a castle, and it's brutal. I mean, it's definitely changed since the onset or the first opening the doors of on Christmas Eve, I believe. I think it was 1884, 1887. I should have had that ready, but it was right around that time. And like I said, it was just, you know, the worst of the state. And even the worst from out of state comes here, and that's the thing about this particular penitentiary, is that, you know, you see a lot of shows that goes like Eastern State Penitentiary and places like that, or people will check out Waverly and things like that, you know. But there's a certain energy that's in a still functioning facility,
right? And that's the key. I mean, I've worked as a researcher and a producer on Ghost Stalkers and Ghost Asylum, and you know, we're always finding abandoned penitentiaries to investigate. We're always finding places where, you know, it's been 20, 30 years before they've been actively used. And, you know, there's kind of a a bit of a disconnect between the living that are coming in there to investigate and the dead that are there haunting it. But with a place like this where it's still active, I mean, they're both rubbing up against each other every single day.
Well, it really is, and that's the thing is – but and there's even more sides to all that. You have to factor in, obviously, the people coming in there to work, dealing with, you know, the job stress, the job violence, the structure of it. Believe it or not, a lot of the people that are incarcerated there weren't model citizens or they wouldn't be in there. And they definitely didn't do well with structure and following the rules. But that place is set up in a very militaristic style. You know, there's the, you know, captain, lieutenant, sergeant, you know, that type of pecking order. And everything goes through channels and everything is a certain way. And that in itself hobbles these guys. And that's the main thing that I took away from it is that people said, you know, I've talked, you know, to inmates that have been at different facilities and said, I've been able to do good time. Because, you know, good time, you keep yourself busy, you do this and that. And said, but I've never done hard time like I did before I came to the Kentucky State Penitentiary. So just everything about this place is restrictive. Everything about this place is it's just numbing. I grasp at words, which is silly, I guess. I should be able to, like, rattle it off since I experienced it. But I try to put it into words and where it doesn't sound – I don't want it to sound hokey. I don't want it to sound being facetious about anything. It's just I'm trying to carry the weight of it.
Right.
I'm trying to express that weight. And you never – even in, you know, the 10-plus years, you know, that I did this kind of work – you know, I will still, even after the things I would experience, still have dreams about it, still have nightmares about it. Now, I have friends that called me, you know, people that, retired and this and that, or went on to other state work and things like that. And inevitably, in our conversations every so often, it would be like, yeah, you know, you ever think about the penitentiary? And I'm like, well, I mean, since I write about it, yeah, you know, it kind of is sort of there, but... But yeah, I mean, it stays with you, and it, regardless if you were in there 24 hours a day or an 8-hour or 10-hour shifts, it leaves an indelible mark on you, and that's the craziest thing that I've really found from that. Because you know, I've checked out other facilities, I've checked out old mental hospitals and things like that. Just there's nothing with this sort of visceral, just energy, if you want to call it that. And understand, the way I try to write this book was I try to pretty much do it like the old Dragnet series, you know, just the facts. You know, if someone saw a shadow, I didn't say, well, it was a ghost or it was this type of haunting or it's necessarily or this type of energy. Sure. I would say this is what they saw. Now, I might at the end give a conclusion if, you know, if they ask me what I thought it was and you know, in my time of study, you know, obviously everybody does their research in their own way.
And some stories will tie together too.
Well, sure,
there'll be natural connections.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the thing. You know, the facility was built on inmate labor. You know, there was people hurt and killed in the production and in the construction of it. The onset, there was a lot of bad sewer problems. Killed a bunch of people. It's just a constant, you know, bleeding out.
Go
ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, that's one of the things about penitentiaries that were built of that era, is if you look at facilities that are built now, the more modern facilities, it's all about efficiency. You know, it's about the fact that you're going to be shoving as many bodies as you can in there, so you try to find a way to make it work. If you look at the way that they were built 100 years ago and even before that, it was about inflicting the mental anguish of, I don't ever want to go back to that place ever again. And that was the idea behind the concept, was to make a place that would be so horrible that you would want to do everything in your power to not have to go back. But that same type of an atmosphere also must play on the guards as well, and the people who have to work there that didn't do anything wrong, that are just there to make a living.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Sometimes when we would have someone, like, having a fight on the yard or different things, you know, assaulting an officer or whatever, you would have to go in, and which I understand at this penitentiary, at least when I was there, you know, you didn't carry mace, you didn't carry billy clubs, guns, any of that. You know, you would have a radio and your mouth to hopefully be able to talk these guys down. I was always pretty well versed at being able to kind of joke with these guys and a lot of times get them to laugh and kind of break the fight up, which that might sound really silly, but like I said, you come in there with what tools that God gave you. And because, like I said, they're not going to give you a gun on that yard, obviously. But and that's the thing. You go in there, and a lot of times, it's again regimented, and the officers, just like the inmates, know when it's time. For let ins, let outs. They know what cell houses are going on which days of the week first. It's very regimented, and when that changes, or something happens, any sort of altering of that schedule, plays hell on the whole thing. Pardon my language. Plays heck on the whole playing field. And the longer you're there, it's harder to tell. And I say this with respect, but you can't work with anybody and not pick up certain language, certain body posture, certain behaviors. If you put a 20 year veteran officer with a 20 year inmate and a pair of the same clothes standing on the street, it'd be hard to tell them apart. Just due to the fact of time is time, and it affects you. It's just a fact, and that's the thing. Even beyond the hauntings of whatever energies and events that were left over, kind of as I've always referred to it, permeating the walls of the place, the people leave haunted. I know I did. And that's just, again, another facet of the energy of that and the power of that place. The facility was built overlooking the old town of Edival, Kentucky. The original town of Edival and Catawba, Kentucky, which is in western Kentucky, was taken over in a land grab by the TVA, which, they ran electricity up through here and dammed up the water and all that. Well, anyway, the towns were gone. But all the construction is mainly limestone, and it's quarried from local stone, and with inmate labor. There's running water next to it. There's cave systems that's full of water under this part of Kentucky. So again, running water has a certain energy. Limestone, a lot of people believe limestone, just like a quartz crystal or quartz whatever, can hold certain energy. So it's just like it's a constantly renewing machine, and usually what it cranks out is bad dreams, bad times, and sometimes death.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is it's you mentioned in the book that it's Kentucky's only supermax prison, and that it has that's where Death Row is located. So there's got to be a lot of negative energy that's being put out there on a daily basis, and then being recorded, being held in by these factors, by things like the limestone, and charged up by things like the running water. So you're basically just feeding all this negativity into this one location, and it has nowhere else to go.
Exactly. I mean, it's a tinderbox, and that's why every so often things explode. We had had a assault on, if I'm not mistaken, it was 8 officers and some supervisors, and I knew a lot of those guys. Heck, I worked with and trained some of those guys in my time back at the penitentiary. And that stuff still bothers me. Even though I'm, it's kind of one of those deals, once you're in, you're always kind of in. I still consider those guys friends. And even though I didn't, I wouldn't want anything to happen to them. But obviously, your heart drops. You hear, oh, there's been a riot at the so-and-so. And you're just like, oh, my buddy Terry or, Kevin or whoever is working. Boy, I hope they're okay. And, It's just it happens that quick. I know in my first, I think it was my first week there, I didn't have an officer hurt, but we had an inmate in segregation in the segregation unit somehow get a hold of a staple in his legal mail, and not to be too descriptive, but he basically tried to saw his member off, and so I come on to shift running up there, and blood was all over the walk, and they're trying to get this guy tied to a gurney. He's losing his mind, freaking out, screaming, and you could just feel the tension on it. Everybody's beating, banging the walls all through the cell house, screaming, and they're like, here. So they're pushing the gurney. He says, here, you got to hold this towel over this guy's stuff, or he's going to bleed out. You know, and I'm, and I mean, I didn't even have time to put on gloves. I mean, it was that quick. So, you know, I mean, welcome to the jungle. I mean, that's literally how I was welcomed to the penitentiary. And then beyond that, you know, it's when things, when you kind of get past that new phase and you're really able to study what's going on, that's when you really start to encounter the underbelly of it.
Just with a staple, I can't imagine even how you go about trying to do that.
Well, I mean, I don't want to give a tutorial on what happens, but obviously, you know, there's concrete and things in there, and you sit and kind of scrape down on it. You get a little bit of an edge, and man, and you just sit and saw. You got all time. You got all that time. And apparently he had it for, I guess, a couple hours. It was, you know, apparently it was a new officer, didn't understand, you know, didn't think about it. You know, I mean, we've had guys keep a pen and try to swallow pens and, you know, get out to the outside hospital. We've had them insert them into the urethras and all. Just madness. Just all, anything that you can think of pretty much is happened in there. And a lot of that, that goes to show you the confinement and the effect on people. But this individual, when I was going to say, when I spoke to this person, I actually had wrote a story about what he had said, why he did it, because I was like, I don't understand it. Because I spoke to him when he was in the hospital. The guy seemed pretty articulate, and I was trying to ask him what's going on. He says, just I keep hearing stuff in the cell. Keeps, you know, it's, you know, I hurt myself and things leave me alone, and you know, and actually had people seeing people in his cells, like in his cell when he wasn't in there, you know, just oddball stuff like that. And who am I to argue with that?
So you come there to work, and when was the first time that you heard a story that you would kind of consider to be something paranormal or supernatural?
Well, a lot of times, the way the walks were set up, okay, think of if you have a capital letter E, you lay it down with the prong sticking out to the left. That long hall that connects all three of them, that's your main hallway. That's got your officers the officer desk area and all that. And you have individual halls, which usually have two, a side A, side B, and then the next one is C, D, and then the last one is a single, which is E, which is usually for kitchen workers and janitors. It's sort of like meritorious, you know, so you don't have to stare at some guy, you know, taking a crap or doing God whatever else in the cell. And, yeah, that's what started happening. You started hearing stuff that people were hearing things, you know, coming down the walk, coming up the stairs, hearing locks smack up and down when there's no one there, when there's no one on the walks, whispering when you go past cells, there's no one in the cell, things like that. And some of that could be written off to this and that. But when you have multiple people reporting the same spot, and that's what was really weird, you know, because, I mean, I'd seen what appeared to be some sort of shadow, but it was it wasn't a shadow. It was like a form. It didn't like break. It didn't like fold in when going across the wall. I mean, it was solid. It just floated across. Things like that in like a shower where there had been a guy got really brutally beaten, pretty much beaten to death. He died from complications of it, and this was years ago. And that's the crazy thing is that no one would talk about it. That's the reason that the book was written by me, because no one else wrote it. No one wanted to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those, you know, no one's going to believe you anyway type deals. But once people knew that, because by that time, I had started doing, I guess you would call it a more of a research team, an honest to goodness kind of research team in 2006, the Caldwell County Paranormals. And up until that point, you know, I'd always, you know, read and did research and things like that. And all that, you know, stuff that got us into this, you know, listen to Art Bell and guys like Jim Mars, and, you know, God bless him and his family. I'll just say he kept me entertained and enthralled for many years. And it was when I heard that, just like your friend Tim had said, I was like, ah, man, please let this be clickbait. Let this be just some god awful, you know, thing. And yeah, it really bothered me. you know, because I'd actually got to speak to Jim before on another show for a little bit, and he was always a real down-to-earth guy, and he never put on airs, and I appreciate him being who he was. But as of, again, like you were asking about the prison, I did not hear a whole lot initially until they sort of knew that I studied this sort of thing, I was open to it. And then a lot of times the older officers would kind of joke in front of the captains or something, but then when they're gone, it says, hey, I didn't want to say this in front of Lieutenant so-and-so because he would ride me about it. But, yeah, over in four cell house on the back stairs, yeah, you'll hear stuff, you know, people walking in like hard, the old-timey, like wooden-type heeled boots, and you'll hear this and that in the kitchen and kind of confirming some of the stuff that I've heard. And then it got to the point once the old-timers that had been there with 20 years under their belt kind of basically vouched for me, then here comes everybody else. And then that's where really the influx of stories happened. Because, like I said, I never planned on writing. This whole writing thing is weird to me. I had collected some stories after the fact for my own kind of personal research and stuff. And just because I'd never dealt with any place like that. But it was just sort of a happenstance. A friend of the time had mentioned, you know, he knew a editor, and could he borrow a story to show him? And I'm like, I don't care. And anyway, long story short, he comes back and says, hey, you're going to write a book. That is probably the most nerve-wracking thing to tell anybody, especially people that have written, had submission letters, doors slammed in their faces. Thank you very much, but this story isn't what we really want to do. But that's what happened. It was the most synchronicitous, if that's a word, type of thing I'd ever fell into. Because I have done a lot of stuff. I've done radio. I've done, you know, music. I've played, you know, rock bands and metal bands and stuff forever. But nothing ever really hit. And for some reason, the response to the book has actually really surprised me. Again, because I am from Western Kentucky, it's very conservative, and most people here live kind of faith-based lives and stuff, and so they kind of look at, you know, ghosts and stuff like that as demons. But again, I try to present it in a way of going, look, this is what was told to me, and, you know, mix it in with some history, local history, and some urban legends of the area, and people could kind of they could take it a little bit better, you know. Which it's, again, not my job to sell the paranormal to people. I mean, I guess it is. Technically, I'm writing books about it, but you know what I mean. I'm not here to convert anybody, and I'm definitely not what I would call an expert. I mean, that's the thing. It seems like there's a lot of that going around, you know. Everybody's certified, everybody's this. I mean, and, you know, unless you've really went through and researched a lot of theology and metaphysics and stuff like that. You know, my degree work was in criminal justice, which, you know, helped a lot to check out locations, you know, grid patterns, investigate stuff, you know, disprove stuff and get an idea, you know, and be able to, again, verify or, you know, get rid of, you know, various claims that I found to be untrue or just wrong. And like I said, I say that not to be self-deprecating, but it's just a truth. I'm not going to sit here and try to sell you a bill of goods because that's just not how I am. But yeah, it seemed like the further it went, certain things would just repeat. Certain things were seemed kind of loopy, or like, you know, a sort of a looping type residual haunt, and then there's some things that seemed like it changed up, or it seemed to ramp up over time. And that's what I found really interesting. And you know, I will still speak to people, like I'll have new officers or sometimes old officers that contact me and say, you know, I always worked over here. I never worked in this spot. Someone told me about your book. I'm reading chapter blah, blah, blah. This is exactly what I'm seeing. Or this is similar to what I'm seeing, but it's actually worse now, which tells me that there's a lot of obviously there's a lot of tension because they just had a riot not a few weeks ago.
No, wow.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I've always found fascinating about prisons and penitentiaries is that people will say when you have a haunting somewhere, and it could be anywhere, it could be a house, it could be a building, a business, what have you, they say, well, you know, we have to go back and do the history. Let's find out, did anybody die here? And with a prison, not only do you know that somebody died, especially a prison that has a death row in it, you know that people have died there. You know that there have been murders that have happened. You know that there have been deaths that have happened. Some people are there just to die in prison. Some people are there to be put to death in prison. Some people just end up getting killed by someone else when they're in prison. And it's not like they go far. A lot of the times they're buried right in the Potter's Field right nearby. So you've got all that death concentrated in this area, and that's going to weigh on everything that goes on there just from the minute you walk in. I remember when I was researching Holmesburg Prison for Ghost Stalkers, and I was talking with the former warden. His name was Dave. I can't remember his last name. But he said, when you go into a prison to work, and you've been through something tragic that has happened. He happened to have lost some of his fellow brothers in a riot. He says, when you go in there every day, you are reliving every day the worst day that you've ever had. And at the same time, you are reliving everybody else's worst days of their life all there and all at once, all in the same time. And that creates a palpable atmosphere.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's even if you don't necessarily have like PTSD, it's like a walking, you know, breathing PTSD episode. And it's, like, as I mentioned before, it's so regimented, and it's like it's on a loop in its own right, almost like the – do you remember that movie Groundhog Day? Mm-hmm. Kind of like that. Every day is the same. And every – I mean, that's the thing. That's what wears officers down so much, just that whole looping just mess of negativity. And it can affect you. It can affect your home life. It can affect your relationship with your wife and your kids. I mean, that's why, there's a really high suicide rate in officers. I had a really good friend of mine, Richard Colliver. He was actually a member of our team, and he ended up taking his own life. And that was, I know I'm kind of stumbling over that. It still affects me.
Understandable.
But he took his own life, and that was about six to eight months before I said, yeah, I'm done. Because I brought this kid in, and he was a pretty good kid, religious young guy, Catholic, and it was too much for him. And what really got me was that, and this is why I'm telling you this, it shows you how people's hearts can change. You know, you would expect some inmates to have something silly to say. I heard roundabout ways of, like, officers saying silly stuff about the guy. You know, the guy just died, and it was just sort of like, I'm done with this. So that's when I started working on trying to get to where I can teach life skills to special needs adults, which is what I do now. And it's an important job, and it's a good job, especially for this area. And it's not a job – and when I say this, I don't say it like with bravado, that it's not a job for everybody, but it's simply not. If you can't shake it off and go home, don't go there. If you don't have somewhat of a moral center, don't go there, because not only will the inmates pick you apart – some officers will pick you apart, and then once you're open, that's when whatever is inside those halls will pick you apart.
Well, we are talking with Steve Asher. He is the author of the book Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. And you know, Steve, we're talking about some of the factors that play into these haunts and some of the ways that they happen, but I'm assuming that the Kentucky State Penitentiary has some very unique haunts, some legends to them that are uniquely tied into this particular structure.
Well, sure, and you know, I think like every prison, like, you know, Alcatraz would have like Al Capone and the Birdman and things like that, and you know, there are a few famous characters, you know, that's been at KSP. There's one guy by the name of Kelly Moss, and he went there. He had kind of had a rough life, you know, drinking, partying, roughneck guy up through the 50s and all this and that, just always in and out of trouble, and ended up bludgeoning his father-in-law with a hammer in his kitchen. And anyway, and he come to prison, and he really didn't really slow down much. And this is back during the time when it was, you know, pretty much guys fighting toe-to-toe in the middle of the yard. people getting gutted, choked out, hung, all that stuff, rape, just often. This is actually my father, Louis Asher. He'd worked there back in the 50s, and he knew of Kelly Moss. And after Kelly Moss was executed, he had the electric chair. People started reporting things, you know, not working, things being knocked over, things being, you know, picked up and thrown, no one's in the room, things like that. Then people would start seeing shadows back where his cells were at, or back by the death house, or outside in Rec, where he, a spot where he always wanted to go. People start seeing his shadows, stuff like that. And it's strange that I actually tried to find a photo of Kelly Moss, and it, I mean, go online, good luck. I mean, I challenge you tonight after, look up Kelly Moss, Kentucky State Penitentiary. It was executed in 1962. Nothing. There's nothing. It's like, it's almost like they tried to erase it, which luckily I had some friends in Frankfurt that was actually able to help me find a picture of this guy. And what is so strange is that there was a guy who had actually, again, had saw his, what he said was his ghost, and coming through some razor wire. And he was like a kind of a mischievous guy. He'd either knock you out or pull a joke on you, the way I understand it. But anyway, and about scared this guy in a wall stand to death. And, you know, the image of the creature or whatever kind of looked at him, kind of chuckled, and he faded out. And I asked the guy, well, what'd he look like? I've never heard, you know, and he described him sort of a Irishy-looking guy, you know, balding, whatever, you know. And which I found the picture of the guy, because I asked him, have you ever seen him? He says, no, I just, this is what the guy looks like. And at the time, they had asked some old-timers, again, who knew the guy, and said, well, yeah, that's what he looks like. And it's just strange. It's just strange when someone who, you try to disprove it, and somebody has no knowledge of what this person looks like, or their body postures and stuff, and they're kind of dead on with that, especially considering it took all but an act of Congress for me to be able to get a fax copy of what this guy looked like. And but no, I mean, that's the thing. We've had down at the penitentiary, there's been, you know, again, lots of riots, lots of fires, lots of stabbings, lots of rapes, lots of you name it. And there was actually in the yard office, there used to be connected to the old hospital or the infirmary. There had been a guy that was working in there. His name, they called him Old Red, black guy. And there was a real bad fire. And he actually ended up getting all the staff out, ended up getting all the inmates out. And to the point of him running back and forth, he, you know, got his lungs seared real bad and got, you know, his legs and stuff burned up. And anyway, he ended up passing away. And but some of the stuff went from the old hospital to the new infirmary, and wasn't very long when they start hearing, again, people dragging stuff through there, people clopping through the hallways, people moving stuff, you know, and but they would smell like the stench of burnt skin and stuff like that. So it's one of those quirky things. If I hadn't heard some of the things down there myself, I would have to go, eh, okay. I had a friend, which I just spoke to him the other day, by the name of Morgan. I had wrote a chapter called Old Red, and he was down in the infirmary, and he had all that, and he called me and said, hey, Steve, man, you gotta talk to me. And he said, I think I'm cracking up. And I said, what's going on, bud? And so he told me what was going on a little bit, and I said, okay, hold on. And I described what he's hearing. I described the lock smacking up and down. I described this and that. And he's like, how did you know that? He said, I've worked down there. I know exactly. It's just Old Red. And he's not going to bother you. Just say, hey, Red, I've got this. Go lay down, buddy. Good job. Have a good night. I've got this. And after that, it slowly diminished in probably about 35, 45 minutes, and then the rest of his night he was fine. And which is weird, which to me, that is more of an active thing, because if it was looping, it would just keep going. You know, but, and again, that's happened to a whole lot of different officers. I mean, in the process of writing that book, I've spoke to 100 different officers, but, you know, I only put about 20 large chapters in the book, because a lot of times some of the officers had the same story, or maybe they were working the same thing and they experienced the shadows, but not the, you know, the chills or not the this and that or not something being drugged or bounced in the hallway. But so what I'd do is I would combine some of them to make a little bit more dramatic story where it included all that to make sort of a bigger story, but it was all from the different officers. And that's what's so crazy about it is that even to this day, it's still sort of even after the book come out, because I waited for the explosion. I waited to go, you know, for it would be chastised and this is BS and all this, you know. Because it's one of these things, penitentiaries have a hard enough time doing their thing without them, everyone thinking it's haunted. But, you know, it is what it is. But for the most part, they didn't freak out too bad. I did ask to see if I could come back and visit the penitentiary because apparently a lot of the inmates bought the book. And I thought, hey, it'd be kind of cool to kind of like a Johnny Cash thing, come in there and sign some stuff. But I don't know. They may not let me go if I did that.
Well, there's a question in the chat room, Steve, and we're talking with Steve Asher. He's the author of Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. There's a question from Madonna in the chat room. And she wants to know why. She wants to know if there are certain areas in the prison that you know have more activity, and that you might see the effects that it has long term over the inmates. Like, I'm sure there are some inmates where you say, I know that when we were like researching Holmesburg, for example, there was one block where all the bad stuff happened, and they would be very cautious about which prisoners they could actually put on that block because of their own mental stability and because of their own history and all that. Is that something that you had to take into account, where you could place the living when you had all of these strange things that were also going on at the same time?
Well, sure. Let me explain it like this. I don't know how much you know about state facilities or anything like that, but the way it works is this. You may have one cell house or one building there that's had five or six different lives in 100 years. It may have started out as a death row, and then they built a new death row, and that became regular housing. Or it may have been, you know, part of the gymnasium that they converted and changed into, you know, a cell house. Or it may have been a cell house, and they broke it down for administrative buildings, which is one of the things that happened there. Three cell house, which is a segregation unit, is broken into left and right wings, and you would have like 11 left, 11 right, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14, and then down to 15. Mm-hmm. And 15 walk was the old death walk, and it still had the old, what they called old Sparky, the old electric chair. And no one wants to be down there. Even the officers don't want to be down there. I'd experienced, you know, nausea and stuff like that down there, and it's not, and understand, when I say that, I'm not one of these guys that see spooks in corners, or I don't, you know, see like, you know, Jesus in my toast in the morning. You know, I'm pretty much a nuts and bolts kind of guy as much as I can, other than writing, you know, about ghosts and stuff. But certain areas really affected me, and I think part of it is the fact that, you know, if you investigate places, you get a little bit, I think your barometer gets a little bit stouter. Maybe, you want to call it your radio, you know, you can pick up frequencies a little bit better.
Yeah. You get a sensitivity to it, yeah.
Sure. And I mean, again, I'm not saying in any way, I'm not saying I'm empathic, I'm not saying I'm Miss Cleo or nothing like that. I'm just saying, you know, you, just like a hunter, you walk through the woods, you know, most people might walk past, you know, a broken limb or see something and see, they see where something's rutted down. They can see where whatever. They know the lay of the land, and it's the same thing in that. But yeah, death walk was pretty hopping. There's four cell house, which again was a death walk. You'll see stuff on cameras. I've seen stuff on the monitors. Like orbs. I'm not talking like a, you know, like a blink of light or a bubble. I'm talking like a, like you put like a halogen light inside like a beach ball, and that thing's radiating and flickering and solid. I'm talking, it gives off light to where it would come up and it would make the camera haze because it's so bright, and it would drift, you know, shoot off to the left or the right, and then it would dim down and come back to normal lighting. I mean, really, really brilliant, you know, formations of, what we're going to call it, plasma or whatever. And that's just the thing. I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, you have places like that, like I said, especially segregation. You have places in Six Cell House, which is now the new death row. That's the thing. About every one of those cell houses has served death row at one time or another, which really helps to facilitate a lot of that. 14 Left, which is also on three cell houses. I know I'm throwing out a lot of cell houses at you, but you asked, is known as the Cutter's Walk. This is where, obviously, self-abusive people sometimes they have mental problems. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've dealt with some guys in there, and obviously I'm not a psychiatrist, that, you know, you could kind of tell maybe they're playing, trying to get attention, maybe this and that. But I've also seen some guys, their eyes scared me. And I don't say it like, you know, I'm a 6 foot tall, you know, 300-pound guy. And I don't say it like whatever, but I mean, I don't get spooked by convicts real easy. But I was just like, this guy ain't right. And I don't know if he came in there that way. I don't know if something messed with his head, got into his head that way. I don't know if he just, you know, it's sort of a thing too, where sometimes it's easier to become the aggressor. Mm-hmm. It's easy, yep. you know, you become the aggressor, you're not gonna get preyed on. It's a very prison type thing. But it seems like sometimes things make peace with the darkness in there. It does seem like sometimes people are easy prey for it, and sometimes people, it's like they're ready for it. You know, and it doesn't seem like they're bothered by it. It seems like the ones that's really bothered by it is the ones that's trying not to be bothered by it, or maybe the ones that, you know, obviously, I don't know how many people you've talked to about, like, off into, like oppression and things like that, like spiritual things like that. But it seems like it happens. And even if you're not there that long, I've seen a lot of officers change like that. And they'll go home and have something from there follow them home. Right,
that's got to be the scariest part, because you're already trying to think to yourself, you know, I've got to compartmentalize this job, but I've got to keep what I deal with on a daily basis at work and not bring it home with me. And then to have something unseen like that follow you home has got to be terrifying.
Right. Well, that's the thing. And humans have this weird ability, some of us anyway, to compartmentalize things. You see it really strong in, like, serial killers and things like that. Not that I'm saying officers are serial killers or inmates or whatever. Well, there are some inmates that are serial killers, obviously. But you can only do that so long. You can only play that game so long. Because sooner or later, it's all going to come back together. And that's what's so crazy, is that it makes it sometimes really hard to read it, because you have to go, okay, what's psychotic behavior and what's spirit behavior? I mean, obviously, you have things moving around. I mean, short of telekinesis or some sort of psi power, but you have things, you know, dragging across this and that, or getting thrown, and, you know, lights going out and off and on and rolling around, and just, I mean, like I said, you pretty much name some sort of spirit activity or paranormal activity is happened there. And that's the craziest thing, is that, again, it just blows my mind. In the times that, like I said, the book's been out, probably about a year now, since it was released. And so, as part of the thing of writing, again, like I said, I didn't plan on being a writer, it just sort of happened. I didn't know anything about book signings. I didn't know anything about appearances. I didn't know anything about half of that junk. So I had to start doing, like, you know, going to bookstores and signings and stuff. And I would start having other people come up to me from, like, the whole gambit of this. I would have officers that's like, hey, well, you didn't mention one certain place. And I'm like, well, I've kind of heard about it, but I don't have anybody that gave me a full story. And they would give me a full story. I would have people that had been in there, like serving, that served out, or maybe, oh, my son so-and-so had been back there in the 70s and he talked about this. And then I can get in touch with that person to verify this and that. And there's another story. I mean, it's so crazy that I thought I had it all. I thought I had it all, to the point where I've actually collected enough stories that I will probably the next year or so release a follow-up to that. I mean, I've already got the second, if it's okay if I talk about it.
Sure.
The follow-up, it's going to still be part of the kind of Hauntings of series, but it's going to be the Western Lunatic Asylum, which is about the Western Kentucky Hospital, or Western State Hospital in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And that's, again, this part of the country, it's still a functioning facility. And that's just, you know, it's so crazy that it seems like there's the same sort of manic energy, there's the same sort of tortured energy, and there's the same sort of, like you said, oppressive, you're here to pay for your crimes in the old asylums. Because, again, you know, modern medicine and mental health and stuff is went leaps and bounds. They generally don't do, you know, a lot of water baths anymore. They don't do like lobotomies and stuff like that anymore. So, but all that happened there as well. So, and that's the thing. There's been a lot of stuff that happened at the penitentiary that would border on that. You know, there's a lot of violence. There used to be an area, which I didn't even mention that, beneath the penitentiary called the dungeon. And these were specifically put there with whipping blocks, shackled walls, all that, you know, and, take a guy down there, and what I think the term was to get their head right. You know, someone's been acting up. Sometimes they take them down there and just wear them out. And, you know, I was sort of like, eh, okay, you know, but I never really got to see it. We had a flood. We had a water tower in the middle of the yard that got hit by lightning and flooded out the whole administration building, which is what had been an old cell house, which is where the dungeon was over. So I had to help the engineers to get down there and try to get some stuff open so it would drain. And I kept hearing this clanging. I'm like, what's going on? What's going on under there? He says, well, that's where all the old the dungeon was at. And they actually was able to show me where there were still standing chains clanging against the wall in the rushing water. And so I was like, wow, you know. And it seemed like once that opened up too, activity really picked up in there. It seems like once you kind of stir that up and revisit that, and especially, you know, also with, you know, water again and all the, you know, the elements and stuff, it seems like it does agitate it. Just like, you know, when's the best, when did everybody talks about ghosts and things like that? It was a stormy night. You know, it always seems like there's some sort of natural element that ties into it.
Sure. Well, you've got the water charging things up. You've got the, you know, if you have a thunderstorm, you have the lightning charging things up. So it makes sense. And it's also creepy enough that you start paying attention to things, too. That's the other part of it.
Well, I worked, excuse me, I had worked on all three shifts in my time there, but a good majority of my time, I worked midnight shift. My wife, Cheyenne, and me, we have three girls, and we had two little boys that we've adopted that are special needs. And so I spent a lot of overnights, so I would make sure that someone was there with the other kids during the day so she can go on doctor trips. And that was pretty much how it was and up to the time I left. But it's just like if you're standing across a field, middle of the day, with a flashlight, you're not going to see it. Wait till it's about midnight. You turn that light on, yeah, you're definitely going to see it. And it seems like all the things that keep your mind focused off on this and that are gone. The small hours, that's when people really see stuff, and that's when it seems like things are very active. I mean, I've definitely seen stuff happen, heard things happen during the day. You know, things happen there day and night. But there's just something about, man, there's just something about after midnight. And that's really between, usually between 2:30, 2:34, maybe by 5, if anything was going on, it's definitely quit by then, because you're letting kitchen staff or kitchen inmates out to be released, right, yeah, to go to the kitchen to work. But, and it seems like once that activity kind of happens, it maybe it's still there, you just don't notice it. But yeah, I don't, you know, if I was pressed to the wall and say, you know, you definitively, can you say, is a penitentiary haunted? No, I can't. I can speculate. I can say, in my experience, Do I feel most likely there's something going on there? Yes. Some sort of mystical energy, some sort of entities? Yes. Is it a ghost? Is it whatever? I can't say that.
Well, that seems like a good place to leave it. But again, the name of the book is Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. Steve Asher is the author. And Steve, how can people follow along with you online, and how can they find out when the new one comes out?
Well, we go through Permuted Press, which is my home book, guys, which I want to thank, you know, Devin Brown and Michael and Matthew and the other guys there that have given me the opportunity to release it. But it's through Simon & Schuster. You can go to simonandschuster.com, or you can go to, this is all lowercase and together, Steve with another E and then Asher.com. So it looks like Steve would like an extra, you know, Steveasher.com. And that's got links to, you know, my Facebook, my Twitter, my whatever, Instagram, all that good mess. And it keeps, you know, I try to keep up with all my different little appearances and this and that. And that's kind of how they'll find me. And like I said, if not, you know, find me, look for me on Facebook. I'm very approachable. And if you guys are ever in Princeton, Kentucky, you know, look me up. I'm always glad to talk to somebody, sign a book or whatever. And again, it's weird shoes to wear, but you know, I'm gonna enjoy it while I can. Well, I'm able to put books out and have fun with it, and I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, thank you for joining us and for telling us about. You know, there just seems to be something about Kentucky. There's a lot of stories that come out of there. I have friends that live there that have told me strange stories from there, and of course, we know some of the paranormal hallmarks there. So you're definitely in the heart of an area that seems to have a weird energy about it.
Well, that's that kind of Southern Gothic vibe, and I will say this before I go. In the Hauntings of Kentucky State Penitentiary, you know, I did mention, you know, about like what was they claimed to be a hellhound, and upcoming stories. It's going to be touching on, you know, dogmen and some Bigfoot stories. I'm going to kind of pepper in here along with it, just because it's all here and it's all part of a part of our history and a part of the experience of living in this area.
I love it. Sounds good. All right. Well, we'll talk to you when the next one comes out.
Hey, thanks. And I really do appreciate it. And you guys take care. God bless. And I'll be here.
All right. That is Steve E. Asher. Again, the name of the book is Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. You can visit his website, Steve, then with an extra E, SteveEAsher.com. And you can find out all about his books and all about him and his work and follow along with him through social media and everything else. Speaking of the internet. I want everybody to do me a favor. I've been talking about Haunted Towns and about how it debuts August 15th on Destination America. But do me a favor. If you have a smartphone or a tablet or any of those devices, go and download the Destination America Go app. It's free. And as long as you have Destination America on your cable, you can sign into the app. And then that will allow you to watch programming on your device from Destination America. So you can watch Kindred Spirits is on there.
Right.
All the seasons of Ghost Asylum, Paranormal Witness, all these great paranormal shows are on there. But on Tuesday, they're actually debuting the premiere episode of Haunted Towns a week early on the app. So if you can't wait until August 15th to watch it live on television, you can watch it on the app on Tuesday. And I will be definitely checking it out because I haven't seen anything yet.
Really. You haven't?
No. So I want to see how it looks. And I want to see how good it is. And then, you know, that'll give me a jump for, because I plan on live tweeting when it debuts. So that'll give me a jump on things that I can tweet about.
Because I'll already
kind of know what's going to be there.
I can't wait to see it.
So download that and watch the show on this Tuesday, August 7th, and you can get it free. And then, of course, next Saturday night, we're not going to be here on the radio. There's still tickets if you want to join us. If you want to go to Ghost of the Gateway 2017, you can get your tickets at SpookySouthCoast.com. We've got some other things that we're working on coming up for September. I know Stephanie's going to be all over the place in October.
And September.
So there's plenty of stuff happening, and eventually we'll figure out how to put it all up on one calendar on SpookySouthCoast.com.
Yes.
I'm sure Matt knows how and just has to teach us how to do it.
Well, I add the events to our event section on Spooky South Coast Facebook, so definitely check that out.
And of course, you know, so many ways to get out and get involved with everything that we do. I want to thank everybody that popped in on Wednesday for the Bloody Pen, where we talked Lizzie Borden on Wednesday night. That was great. And fascinating stuff from Stephanie Corey. If you are interested in the Lizzie Borden story, If you want to find out more about Lizzie, about the murders, about the trial, about all that stuff, you know, not necessarily from a paranormal end, but from finding out all the true history, tune in tomorrow right here on WBSM for Town Square Sunday. It begins at 6 a.m. It's hosted by Jim Phillips. He will be talking with Stephanie Corey, who is a Lizzie Borden expert, and he'll be talking with her about some of the actual facts of the murders and of the trial and of everything that has to do with Lizzie Borden. So that'll be happening tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. right here on WBSM, Town Square Sunday. And if you are listening from outside the area, or if you're listening to this later on podcast, just go to the WBSM YouTube page. Just go to YouTube and search WBSM 1420. You'll find our page, and you'll see the video right there of Jim Phillips interviewing Stephanie Corey on Town Square Sunday. It's already up there now, so if you can't wait till tomorrow morning to listen, you can watch it right now on YouTube as well. And, of course, we'll have our show up on YouTube as well. You can always get all of our podcasts wherever podcasts are found. We want to thank everybody for listening. So until next time, for Matt, for Stephanie, for Chris, for Ashley, I'm Tim, and we want you all to stay spooktacular.